Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Melissa Kagan, who is the author of Wandering Games. Melissa, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca. I'm very excited to talk about this book with you.
Great. Could you start out before we get into really the nuts and bolts of the book, talking a little bit about why you wrote this book? What was it? And maybe as you do, talking about a little bit what Wandering Games are and how this book sort of came about.
Totally. Great questions all. So I came to this book, this project, through a pretty circuitous path, a little bit meta, how much I wandered around getting to this project. But the book, in one sentence, is about how 21st century ideologies of work, colonialism, gender, and death are reflected in the ways that we wander through digital spaces. However, where I started was with questions like, what does it mean to be a wandering body in a game world? What does your ability to wander within different game worlds say about the way the game is constructed, the kind of game world that is created, and the boundaries of that world, the body that either you inhabit as an avatar or that you have in real life that is in some ways reflected in what you can and cannot do within the game. And, you know, what happens when we take the wandering part of a game seriously? I did not start in game studies. I only came to game studies about 6 years ago. My PhD was actually in German studies. So I was doing all this research on wandering opera, actually. I was interested in early 20th century German Jewish opera, and I was interested in different tropes of wandering in the German context and the Jewish context and the German Jewish context. I was directing a lot of these like site-specific wandering operas. And at some point, someone said to me, you should really play this new type of game called a walking simulator. You just wander through game worlds in that, or you wander, and that's kind of the only thing you're doing in those games. This might be interesting for a person such as you who's dissertating on this concept of wandering. So then I started playing those games around 2013, 2014. And by the time I got my PhD in 2016, I was like, yeah, I should be in game studies. Since then, I've switched focus, and that's what I've been doing.
So could you talk a little bit about like these walking simulator games and what they are and putting them in that context of gaming and video gaming in sort of that larger context? So folks who aren't gamers or who don't, like you said, it's sort of a newer concept. When we think about that, what that kind of means and where that is.
Sure. So my definition of walking simulators on page one is that walking sims are exploratory, nonviolent video games without points, goals, or tasks in which the undying third-person player character, PC, wanders around a narratively rich space. So these are classics of the genre, are games like The Path or Journey or Proteus, and then around 2010 to 2013, they kind of burst into the mainstream scene with hits like Gone Home and then Firewatch, Virginia, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, Tacoma. But I didn't want the book to just be about walking simulators. I kind of wanted to start in that couple years where walking simulators kind of burst into the scene and became really popular in some areas, and also provoked a whole lot of backlash in some other areas of gaming. And I wanted to take this emergence of the genre of the walking simulator and think about how it both didn't come from nowhere, and it also hasn't now disappeared, but rather there is a very long history to people, creative people, thinking a lot about what it means to wander, and that comes into the evolution of the walking sim. And now, in early 2020s gaming, we have games that I would call hybrids that have different elements of the walking sim. That have, it's basically just kind of percolated into gaming writ large. And so, even when we don't have games that are explicitly called walking simulators, although we do still have some of those, we still have a whole lot of games that I'm considering as wandering games, which is to say games where I take the wandering that happens in those games seriously, the way wandering is taken seriously in a walking sim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really fascinating to me because I'm like, oh, I've never, like, it made me think about some of the games I play differently, right? That, like, yes, that is kind of wandering and kind of exploring that narrative. And sometimes you want to get to the end, but sometimes you're like, oh, where's this story going to lead me? Or where am I going to go with this? So, yeah. So one of the things you look at too, or talk about, and maybe we can talk about this, and we'll talk about this more deeply with when we talk about the games, is that this is very gendered, right? And how we think about games and these kind of games. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that kind of gendering of this idea of walking and wandering in the gaming world, and out, and how you talk about it sort of outside of the gaming world, how historically how we look at this.
So gender in gaming, and the gendering of walking simulators is where I originally started with this project. I was quite interested in why this genre of games is kind of gendered female, or sometimes queer-coded. And there's been a lot of really interesting research on women in games and queer people in games, queer game studies, people like Bo Ruberg and Cody Mayor, and Demetrius Pavlunis, have talked a lot about queer aspects of the walking sim. And so the simplest kind of reason why these games get female coded is that in some ways there's no there there. Another way to phrase that is that the pleasure and entertainment of the walking simulator is oftentimes quieter and more abstract, less task-oriented, less violent. So when these games started coming out in some areas of gaming, which is sometimes, I don't want to say all over the place, but some areas of gaming culture are very heteronormative and filled with a kind of macho masculinity. And so the notion of a game where the player is prevented from action struck some people as a very uncomfortable kind of forced passivity, which got coded as female. So these games also oftentimes have attracted a more general audience, which is in a lot of cases filled with a greater proportion of female players and queer players than the overall population of gamers. So that's another reason why they got, why the walking simulator, which was originally this derogatory term for a game that lacked something, you know, what do you do in this game? Like, well, you just walk, like that's all it is. So yeah, those are some reasons why gender came into this project from the beginning and became so interesting to me.
So let's get into the games and talk about some of the other, you know, ways in which you look at these and analyze these. And so you want to just start with, let's start with the first game you talk about. Let's just kind of walk through and maybe talk a little bit about the game and then how you kind of examined it and looked at it. So your first game is Obradin. Mm-hmm. Yes, which my son is a gamer and loves Papers, Please. So I was like, have you done this one? And he's like, no. Like, so I think I think you might have a convert, right? Because he thinks Papers, Please is like the greatest thing ever right now, besides FIFA 2023. But so can you talk a little bit about Obradin, that choice, and the late capitalism, what you were kind of seeing in this game?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, the way I approached writing this book was in each chapter, I look at a different game and then I think, what are the different ideologies and cultural resonances that come up when we think about how we wander through this game? So in each chapter, that means something different because the way we wander through each of these different games I consider is different and brings up different things. So this chapter, late capitalism, with the emphasis on late, I really liked that pun because there's a lot of death and a lot of capitalism in this game. I was thinking about, so caring for corpses in Return of the Obradin is the subtitle of the chapter. And this is a game in which you play as an insurance adjuster for the East India Company, and you are at work. Your job is to go aboard this ghost ship, so a ship that has come back into port in, I think, 1806 or so. It had 60 passengers or 60 humans originally on the manifest, but now it's come back into port and there's no one alive on it any longer. And so you wander around the ship finding the corpses of all of the people who died on the ship, some of whom worked there, some of whom were passengers, some of whom were related to someone who worked there with a passenger. And when you get to each corpse, you can use this magical clock called a memento mori, and you click on the corpse, and it takes you back to the 15 seconds or so before that person died. So I was really interested in this game initially, both because it's just a fantastic game by Lucas Pope. I loved Papers, Please as well, but I think this one is better. It is such intricate narrative work that the game does, that he does, tying together all of the stories of all of these people's lives. And something I found so interesting about it is that you are really... the mechanic is such that you are caught in the moment before the death of each of these characters. And so you're basically exploring this archive of corpses, which was especially interesting to me because I have had previously been theorizing wandering around in some game worlds, like the classic Gone Home, as a kind of archival adventuring. So usually you go into a space in a game and you see a whole bunch of texts and then you read through those texts. And by text, I mean that generally, like maybe they're voice recordings, maybe there's a diary, maybe there's a painting. And you are the archival adventurer. You are trying to put together all of those bits and pieces of the archive and tell that story in a way that makes sense to you as the player. Like you're knitting together the story with your feet. In this game, you kind of have it backwards. You have a whole bunch of bodies that you then are trying to interact with and then make into a book. You get the manifest and you're trying to write down in this mystery story sort of way what the answers are to the question on every page, which is who is this person? How did they die? I forget the third question. But you're interacting with bodies and trying to turn them into text. Whereas in typical walking simulators, you're interacting with text and then kind of turning them into bodies in your mind. So that was the initial place I started there. And then that got me into all these questions about work and what it means that all of these people were working when they died. Most of the characters in this game were working on the ship. And you also, as the investigator, are also technically at work. So there grows this disjoint between you as the player, who comes to care very much for all of these people who die in incredibly gruesome ways. The game mechanic pushes you to really care a lot about their lives, not just their deaths. You have to care about all the relationships on the ship in order to figure out who they were. And so by the end, you're really invested in them. But then you as a player character, as this investigator, all you care about is the dollars and cents, or I guess the pounds and whatever, because it's a British ship. All you care about is kind of the financial insurance payouts. And so that disjoint creates like this real late capitalist gap between what you emotionally might care about as a human versus what you care about as a worker.
Right. And you move us from like thinking about this game to another idea of work, right? And you look at Eastshade, which sounds like a beautiful game, right? Where you wander and paint and work, right? Like, so could you, I have to say that I'm kind of glad I read your book towards the end of my term, because then I have this list of games that I can just play over break. And then tell my children they have to play too, so we can discuss the games. But yeah, so can you talk a little bit about Eastshade and how you see the wandering and gaming in that game as well?
Eastshade was such a beautiful game to play and to wander around. I really loved it. I came back to it as like my comfort game for a while after I played it. And so in this game, you are also at work. But your work is quite different. You are not an insurance adjuster. You are instead a traveling artist. And you wander around this beautiful fantasy landscape that's very safe and very calm, very cozy, very friendly. And you are trying to paint paintings and find commissions. And so what I was really interested in here is the way that there is a gap, again, between kind of the dream, like the romantic vision of what it would be to be a wandering artist, what it is to be a wandering artist, contrasted with the sometimes harsh practicalities, economic, financial practicalities of being essentially a freelance artist. And because this is a game, because it's a fantasy, the game kind of erases most of the harshness of that. But there are still a whole lot of typical RPG economies at play. You're collecting what's called glowstones. So there's like this baseline, like you're collecting money. You also have to collect various supplies. You have to keep your relationships with various characters going. You have all of these different kind of explicit or implicit economies that you have to juggle, all while maintaining the game kind of maintains this relative illusion of the romance of the wandering artist. It's this fantasy of work. And I found that really interesting too, in comparison with, or in conversation with the same sort of types of work that go on in the game industry, including in the creation of this game, where there's all this discourse of laboring, a labor of love, you know, love your work, and you'll never work a day in your life. This whole like discourse about how work has to be the thing that fulfills you and that you put your love into it happens a lot in the game industry and is the cause of a lot of labor violations. And it's one of the reasons why the whole game industry is unionizing right now, because this total imbrication of love and work can get really exploitative for a lot of people. And so this is a fantasy in which it doesn't get exploitative. It's a fantasy in which your work really is lovable and does matter, and you do get fulfillment from it, which is not the reality of that experience for most people in the gaming industry or in general who love their work.
One thing, too, that was super interesting about this game and thinking about that the wandering aspect too, and that it seemed to occur in other games as well, is that you are pushed by people to wander more, right? Like, so sometimes you're like, well, I'm going to, you know, get on the horse, or I'm going to do this, and you're not allowed to do it right away. So there's also this way to push you to explore more and appreciate and be in that space more, which is really fascinating.
Totally. And coming out of, 19th and 20th century German Jewish studies, I was also seeing this strong historical echo of the notion of the romantic wanderer. You're very much a romantic, you know, like a Goethean style, like hero who goes out into the world and seeks his fortune and has all of these beautiful adventures and exciting interactions. And that's kind of the fantasy. And then the practical reality in 19th century Europe was a lot more about journeymen traveling for work and experiencing privations and having to be away from family and having all these inconveniences and difficulties and poverty. You're very much encouraged to wander in this game. And it's in part so delightful because it's kind of the way that emotionally you feel like it should be, rather than the way that historically or currently it ever actually is.
So you move from this kind of wandering, this game where, yes, where you don't have to worry about the money, you don't have to worry about any of that, to this very ritualistic game, which, again, I was like, oh, I will have time to do this for 30 days. So like Ritual in the Moon. So it's not this game where you spend a lot of time on the game, but it really is about like this other kind of ritual. And I love the witchcraft part too. So can you talk about Ritual of the Moon and kind of what you were seeing with this and thinking about body and constraints to the, especially the feminine body and the female body?
Absolutely. So this game had a very different feel from Eastshade. Completely beautiful game. Obviously, I loved all the games because they were all games that I wanted to spend so much time with. This chapter is called Walking in Circles, Bodily Constraints in Ritual of the Moon. Ritual of the Moon is what's called a durational game. You have to play, or you're instructed to play, about 5 minutes a day, and you can only play about 5 minutes a day, but you have to then remember to play every single day for 28 days. The story is you are a witch, you actually are a witch, you haven't just been accused, but you are a witch, and you have been exiled to the moon, and you have incredible cosmic power. And so every day a comet streaks towards the earth, and you can either use your power to avert it, or you can let it hit, or you can actually direct it directly into the earth so that it does hit. And so you're this witch, you command massive astrophysical power, and you also suffer mightily at the hands of the societally powerful. You have been exiled to the moon. You're suffering a lot of loss and heartbreak and loneliness. And so there is this ritualistic element to the game where before you make your choice about the comet, every single day you go into your spaceship and you conduct a ritual. You order several objects, and there is a mantra, and there's an image that, or a visual that seems a little bit like breathing. And then you go back outside and you make your choice of whether to save or whether to destroy. So I read this game as being about constraints on the wandering body, specifically the female body, when there have been these extreme constraints placed around movement, you're denied the chance to exert agency over space and wander around freely. What is left? What do we see then? And part of what I saw was that this game is not just interesting as a meditation on constraints around the female body, but also around other marginalized bodies, disabled body, the queer body, the racialized body. So I read this game through each of those different discourses because each of those constraints are really beautifully depicted in the way that you are and are not constrained in this game.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And so this idea of like the body and constraints also, it seems to like continue in other ways in some of the other games you like look at and you move to. So I'm like, you then move to 80 Days. Right. And I kept wondering, like, the German board game was the board game was fascinating, but now it all makes sense.
Yeah.
But this idea of like, you know, thinking about exploration, and you do that in the next couple of games, and colonialism, but it also is this idea of how we constrain bodies and how we kind of confine bodies. So can you talk about then 80 Days and what is happening in 80 Days in that game? And
sure. So in the next two games, I then move into concerns about colonialism. So my third theme after work and gender, I get to colonialism. This game, really fun. The chapter brings the concept of post-colonialism into the theory of wandering games. I focus on this game called 80 Days that is about a quintessential narrative of exploration and colonialism, Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days, which has been gamified many times and has been retold and filmed many times too. But in this particular game, by Inkle Studios. So both of the next two games are by Inkle Studios, which is obviously a studio that I really admire and appreciate their work. So something that's interesting in this game is that you have this quintessential narrative of colonialism. You have explorers who are from Europe and are traveling around the world in a way that in its initial source text was really orientalist and racist. But here in this game, the explorer is decentered, which is to say, the explorer is decentered, which is a radical choice, both in terms of turning the original source material around and also in terms of games and game design in general. Usually the player character is really catered to in a game. The entire game world, right down to its code, in some games, it kind of remakes the whole world around you as you move through it. You are the center of this universe, which is, of course, part of what makes a lot of games so fun. You know, you're exploring this world that was made for you, especially if it's a single player game. You can feel rightfully kind of at the center of the universe. However, in this game, that gets turned around. So you are not the center of the universe. You are instead kind of wandering through or traveling through all of these other meeting all of these other people in all of these other countries, all of whom, really, their stories are much more interesting than you. So it comes across a lot more like a travelogue than a heroic explorer story, which is this very strong decolonial move, and also a very strong narrative move or narrative design move, because when the player is refused all of their heart's desires, interesting things happen. Meghna Jayanth, who wrote for the game, has this quote that I'm not going to get quite right, but basically, you know, what adventure story do you ever know where the hero gets exactly what they want all of the time? You don't ever see that in a novel because that wouldn't really be that interesting. And so this game creates that dynamic too, that like you are never going to, or it's very difficult to like ever find out all of the stories that are happening in the game, which is fine because it's not about you. And the experience of that feels different.
And you also, with 80 Days, look at the way, you know, you mentioned earlier that this, you know, Jules Verne book has been turned into games literally for over a century, right? And so this idea of how what's going on in this game, 80 Days, sort of is different and changes the narrative around colonialism and around exploration than you saw in a very early board game version of this text. And so could you talk just a little bit about that? Because I think it's fascinating.
Sure. Yeah. So the kind of companion game that I look at in this chapter is a, I'm looking up the date right now, 1884. This game called Trip Around the World, originally in German, Reise um die Erde, was designed by Otto Meyer for Ravensburger. So Ravensburger is still a very famous board game publisher, and this was its very first board game that Otto Meyer and I think Sons? No, just Otto Meyer, designed in 1884, right around the moment that the Jules Verne novel was so popular, and you know it was an immediate hit when it came out. This board game is in a style of board game, a very old style of board game called a goose game. It's basically a spiraling linear board. And on each one of these, 80 spaces, you are treated, quote unquote, that's scare quotes, to all of these poems that reflect or that depict where your character is going around the world. And you know, this is from 1884, and it certainly reads like that. The poems are really racist and colonialist, and in part the function of this game was educational. European children were to play this game and therefore, you know, learn about the world, which is to say learn a very particular and racist understanding of the world. And so an interesting thing that came up when I thought about this game in comparison with the modern version of the story and 80 Days is that here in the board game, we have a shift or a switch between space and time. In Reise die Erde, space is reskinned into time. So each space around the board, you have 80 spaces for representing, of course, the 80 days. And what that means is that there is this fatality to the story of the game. There isn't really a question of whether or not a player will succeed. Of course, a player will succeed. If you keep rolling the dice, there is no way you are going to be unlucky enough as to not eventually get back to your starting point. There's no way to lose. So this is the opposite of what happens in 80 Days, where it's extremely possible to lose. And, you know, I've played it where I've won, I've played it where I've lost, like lots of things happen. The world is not catering to you in 80 Days, whereas in Reise die Erde, it's really implicitly and in its design, making sure that the white audience playing this game is not ever going to be troubled by something like losing. They are going to get to the end point just because of the way that the game is designed.
So the other Inkling games that you look or Inkle Studios game that you look at is Heaven's Vault. So can you talk, and you look at this through a similar kind of post-colonial lens. So can you talk a little bit about Heaven's Vault and what you kind of see and how that is a bit different than 80 Days, but what you see going on there and Wandering?
Totally. That is also an incredibly beautiful Inkle Studios game. And in this game, I was interested in, okay, so let me describe the game first before I jump into it. This is a game that has most often so far been examined through the discipline or the sub-discipline of archaeogaming, which is to say it's an innovative ludic depiction of archaeology and a translation mechanic. So you play as an archaeologist, Aaliyah, and she roams around this fictional nebula following the traces of a missing person. But that's really just the spur to get the game going. The more she learns about this person's disappearance, the deeper she falls into the mythology of the nebula, which is this universe of looping time, abused robots, fallen and forgotten empires, a language called ancient. And that language is the major mechanic of the game. It's inscribed in short phrases on all of these artifacts that she finds during her travels. A lot of what you're doing during the game is learning parts of the language in order to understand what it is that happened in the past of this universe, so that you can kind of put Aaliyah's story together. So this is a chapter in which I looked at the game as a world made up of many different kinds of linguistic fragments. There's a lot of different kind of reading and writing. And Aaliyah both Aaliyah and the player have to learn how to read all this language. And her ability to do so is inflected strongly by her status as a colonial subject who has been educated in the imperial center. She has been educated at the University of Ajax, but she originally grew up in a colonized planet in the universe. And because of this background, she has this multicultural knowledge that uniquely situates her in a way that makes it possible to solve all these vast ancient mysteries. So I then talk about how language historically serves to uphold colonialist norms and how this game gives the player a linguistic space to practice resisting that violence. So the wandering in this game is like wandering through language, and digression is like, how can you push back against the hegemonic violence of an imperial language, which this game gives you a chance to do, which is really cool. And then in the final section, you kind of digress enough that you can get to the point where you can kind of rewrite the whole map you can make the choice to kind of have Aaliyah rewrite the whole map and start over. And so I use some decolonial theory from Edward Glissant and Sylvie Winter, who writes that the bleak story of humanity's future stems directly from colonial violence, and that by writing humanity an alternate past, we could perhaps find a way toward a different future. Which is what I argue Heaven's Vault gives us the chance to do.
So you go, your last two games you look at move us from, many of these games are independent games that you've looked at, sort of smaller games, but then you kind of look into sort of large scale gaming. And so can you talk about those last two games then too, and how you kind of see gaming happening in these bigger gaming companies?
Yeah. So for this last chapter, where I look at Death Stranding and The Last of Us Part Two, I wanted to challenge myself to look at AAA games. So that's big games, big studios, a lot more funding, much larger worlds, oftentimes much more complicated in some ways, games with a lot more possibilities for the player. And both of these games are worlds, are games where the player wanders around a post-human, post-apocalyptic, post-death world. So this was the chapter where I really got to death, although honestly, death has been there since the beginning. Digression has forever in literature been a way to avoid death, and certainly no less in gaming. You know, if you keep digressing, side quest, you will, you try to avoid dying just as a player character, but then you also are trying to avoid the metafictional death, which happens at the end of the game, when you finish the game and then it's over for you. So in both of these games, death gets ratcheted up to a whole new level because you're not just dealing with the metaphorical death of the player character dying, but you're actually in an entire world where some kind of post-apocalyptic, post-death event has happened. And they're different post-apocalypses, post-death worlds. Death Stranding was a little less familiar to me. It's a what was once the United States. You're roaming as basically an Uber Eats delivery man after the apocalypse, and you're trying to connect essentially Wi-Fi networks all across this devastated landscape, where all of these shadowy death creatures are haunting the landscape. And you have this unique biological capacity to come back after your character has died. And then The Last of Us Part Two, you play in a zombie apocalypse, many years after the zombie apocalypse has happened. So what I found when roaming around these games was that I kind of came back to these initial questions I had at the beginning of the project. What does it mean to be a wandering body in a game world? What does it say about the game, the world, the body? And so I looked at the world, these post-death worlds, and I read them as what I called post-apocalyptic pastorals, this kind of nostalgia for a pastoral wandering experience that might only be possible after the end of all things. And that's a trope that we see in a lot of different fictional spaces, like The Walking Dead, you know, the beauty of nature that kind of comes back when different aspects of modern civilization are kind of falling back into a state of nature. And then I also looked at the bodies that wander through these worlds as cursed endless wanderers, that the player might be enjoying all of this endless wandering, but certainly in these two games, the characters, you know, if they had agency to want things, are not enjoying it, and are in both of these cases kind of cursed to eternal life and eternal wandering, which I, to me, felt very connected to the myth of the anti-Semitic myth of the wandering Jew, the character cursed to wander forever and never given rest or redemption or the ability to stop wandering. A bleak end to the book. What I came to by the end of it was that this kind of endless wandering through these post-death worlds experientially feels like a pilgrimage more than anything else, which I thought was really interesting because these are really violent AAA games. And there are these kind of like secret, or not so secret, but kind of subtle and not really advertised aspects of spiritual pilgrimage that happen when you take seriously all of the wandering around that you do. You know, you these characters, they have something very broken in their lives and in their worlds, and they're trying to walk their spiritual world back together. And they kind of don't succeed. And that feels really beautiful too. What emerges is this notion that these games are under the surface digital pilgrimages, attempts to walk our way into a spiritually meaningful experience, despite or even in addition to all this ebullient violence that covers them over.
And so you look at these games and you, can you talk a little bit about what you'd like to see or what kinds of, because in the conclusion, you talk a little bit about what next steps people could do or what you'd like to see people kind of explore next. So could you talk a little bit about that? Like, so what is the next sort of move in thinking about these wandering games and wandering in games and gaming?
Yeah. So I think there are a couple different directions. For one, I think that future work, I mean, I would love to see all of this. I don't know that I would love to do all of this, but I would love if someone would do things like, you know, obviously analyzing other works through the theories, this theorization of wandering games, basically. I'm now at the point where I can look at almost any game that I see and think, okay, like if we take all this wandering seriously, like what does that game look like then? What do we see happening if we really take seriously the wandering? So I think that's possible to do in any number of other games. I could have picked a dozen other games for this book, but you know, these happen to be the ones that I did. So I think just sort of more wandering analyses would be really interesting. I think too, it was quite interesting to look at a single core mechanic across a bunch of different genres. So I would love to either see or do more work that, you know, looks at what it is to just focus in on shooting or jumping or eating as mechanics, and then how it works in a whole bunch of different, you know, different games. And what the history is of that mechanic, what the cultural or ideological resonances are of that mechanic, you know, a book that's all about eating in games. Actually, there's just a book that came out that I'm really excited to read that's called Delicious Pixels. That's all about, you know, eating in games. So maybe this already does some of that. But, you know, I could imagine that sort of piece doing things like talking about consumption and what in-game consumption is. Basically, yeah, looking at a whole bunch of different games that use the same mechanic. I also, you know, my four conceptual through lines here, work, death, gender, and colonialism. Obviously, there's a huge amount more to say about all of those, and especially work. By the end of it, I kind of came to this, got increasingly radicalized by my research on this, and increasingly interested in things like, you know, the unionization of the gaming industry and the way that the work of play operates. So I think more work on work is absolutely called for. Espen Arseth had this field-defining notion in 1997 cybertext about ergodic texts, which are texts that require non-trivial effort to traverse. So in part in this book, I was interested in thinking about what that sort of non-trivial effort or that work that you do to play any game, what that work means in an era where work has become so late capitalist and problematic and so imbricated in love. And so non-voluntary, but also in some ways percolating voluntarily through the entirety of your life. And aspects like the gig economy and platform economics are all coming into the way that we play, whether or not we want them to.
So we've been talking for a while, and so I'm going to ask you my final question always, which is more, what are you working at, if there's anything either with Wandering Games, or what are you working on now? Is there anything you want to put it, and you don't, you might not have anything, but is there anything you want to kind of toss out there for the next project or any promotion or anything you're doing with this book?
Thank you for the question. And the answer is I'm in a far-flung basic research moment, which is really exciting. I'm looking at a whole lot of things and haven't focused in on a next book project for sure yet. But I'm interested in, let's see, I'm really interested at the moment in self-help and therapy games. So all of these games that have been coming out in the last couple years, especially from like self-help influencers like Esther Perel. In kind of conversation with therapy apps and all these different ways that we're trying to gamify mental health as the vibes get worse and as the pandemic kind of continues to make mental health such a front and center consideration. So that's kind of a new area where I'm working on some new stuff about that. I'm also getting really interested in botany games, the game Strange Horticulture. I'm working with a colleague.
I love that game.
Yeah, that game is amazing. And I'm starting to get interested in the way work operates in that game, especially as regards Victorian networks of female scientists, which in this game kind of become witches or witch adjacent. How that's all working. I also just got this new job. So I'm pretty focused on WPI at the moment. And this new role where I'm teaching a whole lot of tabletop games. So I'm teaching a lot of tabletop game design and escape rooms and immersive performance. And so through that, I'm starting to develop some new both creative projects and research projects.
Well, awesome. Melissa, it's been great talking with you. Melissa Kagan, who is the author of Wandering Games, thanks for talking with me for New Books in Popular Culture.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.